name is Matthew Flinders, and I'm one of the co-editors of the journal. It's a great delight to welcome so many of you to a sunny afternoon in Bristol. It's my great pleasure to welcome Danny Dorling along to talk at this next plenary session. I mean, there's a lot of things are spoken about great and well-known academics nowadays, but I think Danny really has just the most incredible prolific outlet.
I've got a job.
Now, there's a reason for that slip of the tongue, because I thought, instead of going through his numerous books and publications, I would do something different. And last year, in the Times Higher Educational Supplement, there was a biographical interview with Danny, which is actually really interesting. And he actually says that one of his favourite things he likes to do is to make sandcastles on beaches. And to make a good sandcastle, you need a warm beach, high-quality sand, and a stream. The stream is the hardest part to get right. It's no good if it's a trickle, and not much fun if it's a sewage outlet. And I've actually just talked to him, and he does plan his family holidays around identifying good streams for sandcastle building. But what I thought was really interesting is that at the end of the interview, it comes back to the challenges of trying to be an academic that also tries to influence and persuade policymakers and politicians. And the interviewer asks Danny, is it worth the effort? And he says, yes. If you have the patience needed to make good sandcastles that are only made only to get washed away by the next tide, then you can deal with policy and politics. But then, and here is the twist, he adds, almost all policymakers and many politicians are very well-meaning and often experienced and can teach you something too. Dealing with particularly cynical or supercilious academics can be much harder than working with the most hard-nosed of policymakers. So it is my great pleasure to have Danny. Danny was, until recently, a colleague of mine at the University of Sheffield. Long before that, he was actually a member of staff here at the University of Bristol. He's going to talk about not just economics, what we know about why social inequality persists. He'll talk for around 40 minutes, and then we'll have 15 to 20 minutes of questions. So Danny, thanks for coming, and over to you.
The other ingredient you need to make sandcastles on beaches is children. You don't necessarily need your own children. Other children will come, at which point nobody realises you don't have any. But it is more easy if you've got your own. What's really interesting on British beaches, I'm afraid we're in one of the worst parts of the country here, if you've got to go some way from Bristol to find some good sand. What's interesting, maybe a bit sad, is that if you do start building sandcastles on beaches, more and more children come because they've got nothing else to do on the beach and they're very bored. And I'll stop my cod theories about what's happened to the British summer holiday at this point and talk to you about what's happened, what I think has happened to British society. And about the aspects of inequality, which are not about economics, or not so obviously economic. The talk is based on two books. Most of it's going to be about injustice. I do have an outlet, it's Policy Press, which publish most of my things. And Injustice was the one where I handed Annie Shaw something which was a million words long a long time ago, and she very kindly cut it to 1/10. So I'm very grateful for that. The other book I'll be talking about briefly is Orders is Solid, about the housing market. And housing is a great example of things having gone wrong in this country. For anybody apart from those who are extremely rich, you'll find getting a house, renting, is one of the most difficult things that you have to do now. But when you're looking at the reasons for this, it isn't necessarily obvious. It isn't just that the market has run away or there's a lack of supply and demand. We've actually had more rooms added to our housing stock in the last 10 years than any other time. We haven't built more houses and flats, we've got some. But we've added 11 million rooms. We now have more rooms per person in this country than we've ever had. So if we've got all this space, how come housing cost so much more? We've never had as many empty rooms as we have now. And what's happened is good news. We've aged. We have a housing system that was very good for when we died in our 70s. We tend to vacate family homes at an efficient age. We're now aging, we're now living longer. But when you talk to elderly people in large houses, you often find that they complain about the size of the house. They can't clean it. They certainly can't afford to heat it. They would much rather move somewhere nearby that was smaller. When you ask them why don't you sell up and downsize? One of the reasons you eventually get to is that what their house represents isn't something for them. It's something for their family in the future. And the longer that they can hang on in that house, which is just one of them, it's a 5-bed house, say somewhere nice in Bristol, the longer they can hang on rattling around in that house, the more money they'll pass on to their grandchildren, which might just give them a chance in the housing market in future. And what you're seeing, I think, is the embodiment of Margaret Thatcher's "there is no such thing as society, there are only individuals and their families." Individual middle class families are having to become their own kind of social security net. And the effect of that is incredibly inefficient. It means using up a lot of space. And so, because people are using up that much space, because so much of our houses and flats are empty, the cost of those who are trying to move into cities is going up and up. So it's a more complicated story than simply supply and demand. What I tried to do in Injustice was trying to understand what people were thinking who think that inequality is a good thing. There is a small group of people who really do think that your level of inequality in the country is a kind of measure of how competitive you are. So there's nothing wrong with having a very unequal country. It simply reflects the fact that your gifted and talented people have worked really, really hard and been well rewarded, and you're not rewarding the stubbornly people who might not try hard enough. It isn't that there's a group who just rub their hands and say, let's make life more painful for the masses. There is an ethic on the right. This ethic is normally hidden because people are a bit embarrassed about it and have been for 30 years, and the embarrassment level has increased. So often you have to get to the footnotes of books by respected BBC editors, say, before you read them writing that actually greed is good and we need this kind of competition. But it's there, and it's there, and it's right amongst the elite. Along with ideas that the children of the elite are specially gifted because they have the genes from the elite children. That's a common belief amongst people in the common British society. Occasionally, somebody gets really cocky, as in the case of George Osborne, and adds an ad-lib to the end of a speech that people might just about notice, because this is almost the final word of his budget speech of this year. It isn't part of the official speech. You've got to go to YouTube and watch George to see him say it. George did a history degree, and so this is George. Maybe it was an early bid for becoming Prime Minister, but it's him talking to his followers and his believers about what he really believes. Every single line in this is, strictly speaking, true. It's like 1984. Yeah, none of these lines are a lie, but I've set myself a task of trying to read these words out at least 25 times before Christmas at various audiences. Because I think you need to understand what you are dealing with. So George said towards the end of the speech, just remember this was a speech for working people. It was Conservatives who first protected working people in the mills. They of course opposed it more than anybody else. It was the Conservatives who took a great step forward to state education, which eventually got rid of the 11 plus. It was the Conservatives who introduced equal votes for women, grudgingly and eventually. It was the Conservatives who gave people the right to buy. That's true. They did. Actually, it's the biggest transfer of wealth to the poor in a short amount of time that ever happened. But then, of course, that wealth has all gone in the opposite direction as private landlords have bought up those houses. So, of course, it is now the Conservatives who are transforming welfare and introducing a national living wage. This is the party for the working people of Britain. The party for the working people of Britain, I think, was a really clever slogan when you were dealing with New Labour, because the gap was so thin between the two that you could stand up and you didn't look completely ridiculous when you said you were the party for working people. I suspect that that slogan may have to be dropped in the next 2 or 3 years because it will begin to be bounced back at them. But we'll see. Let's go back to a very different time. And the reason I want to go back is I want to just show you what's happened to inequality and compare it to other countries. John Maynard Keynes was an optimist. He really did think things could get better. Forget about his theories for how the economy worked. His thinking about how in future we could be so much better off, how we could just be working 4 hours a day, those kind of things, that was all driven by optimism. The predictions, by the way, were for 2030, many of you know the speech about his grandchildren's future. So he hasn't yet been proved wrong. There's still quite some time to 2030. We may not all be working 8 or 9 or 10 hours a day. Working hours, by the way, have been going up for 25 years. What was interesting about Keynes, about the whole Bloomsbury group at the time, was what Oswald Falk, his banker friend, told him. So what he and they were doing was codifying the moral feelings of the age. They were changing the moral sentiment. At certain times, the moral sentiment shifts. The idea of what is right and what is wrong changes. And when it changes, your entire politics moves with it. So it's very hard to notice as it's changing. It also doesn't tend to change that fast. The change builds up year after year. So that you don't notice you become more collective, you become less individualistic, you're less impressed by greed as we became in the 1940s and 50s. You can have a conservative party with an aim of building more council houses a year than the Labour government managed to do, because the moral sentiment had been shifted. The moral sentiment shifted again in the 1970s. It shifted incredibly effectively. This graph has two lines. Both of these lines refer to the top of 1%, the most highly rewarded people in the country. Way back in the 1920s, the richest 1% were getting about 20% of all income, just under 18% after tax. And because we increased taxes, but much more importantly, because wages and salaries at the top did not rise, that take of the 1% fell and fell and fell, down to the 1970s, when the best off 1% were taking just 6% of all income, only 4% after tax. That's just 4 times an average income. In the 1970s, this isn't a mythical time, I can just about remember it, it was my childhood. There was only one large country in Europe which was more equal than the United Kingdom by income inequality, and that was Sweden. We really have transformed from being one of the most unequal to being one of the most equal. A whole series of libels are talked against the 1970s. Not based on any statistics about people's life expectancy, about their freedom to choose what work they did, and so on. All based on the last few years of what happened in the 1970s. I can go on endlessly about why I think the 1970s were the best decade in the last 100 years in terms of freedom. Freedom to go to school with people around you, freedom not to worry about what school you're going to, freedom to choose who you wanted to marry or be with, the beginnings of freedom to choose not to marry somebody, able to get a house for nothing, almost nothing. And we talk about the 1970s as if they're awful. And you could begin to pick and choose where you could live if you're middle class. And if you're working class, it's still hard. But somebody just made Kathy come home and people were bothered about it. They were trying to make things better. In other European countries, particularly in Scandinavia, but not just there, in Germany and in Denmark and so on, and the Netherlands, the list is very long, people carried on trying to make things better in the way that we had been trying in the 60s and 70s. But we turned around. We turned around. 1974 was a crucial year. And ever since then, inequality has risen. You cannot see whether one political party has been elected or another. It really has made no difference, possibly until very recently. I don't think people in Britain, even people who work in social policy, so you can take a lot of your questions later, I really don't think we have any idea of how unequal we are. If you're wondering, why does Jeremy Corbyn stick the word inequality in the things that really bother him so much? These are the kind of numbers you need to see. And I tell you, there'll be numbers for the next 7 or 8 minutes about just how odd Britain has become. This is the ratio of incomes of the best off 10th of the population to the worst off 10th. I'm only looking at the 25 richest countries in the world, and I'm ignoring any country with a population of under 2 million. This is data from about 2010. I'll update it for you in a minute. The most equal country in the world in 2010 of the rich countries was Japan. But the best off 10 still got, on average, 4.5 times more than the poorest 10. The next three countries are Finland, Norway, and Sweden. And then Germany. Interestingly, very recently, a pamphlet was published saying that we can't really compare ourselves with Germany because we're so very, very different. We couldn't possibly have an education system funded like the German education system, for instance. And I'm trying to work out what kind of different Anglo-Saxon people we are to the Germans. Well, the reason Germany is there is because Germany lost a war. The fastest way to become more equal is this war. Same reason for Japan. Not necessarily the reason for Scandinavia. Then Austria, where the borders just closed to Germany, then Slovenia, South Korea, Denmark, Belgium, then Switzerland. Switzerland's not incredibly unequal. The top 1% in Switzerland have an income half our top 1%. When people who work in banking tell you that they will just go and get a job somewhere else, you've really got to ask them where those jobs are. The European Union monitor the number of people in finance who are paid over €1 million a year. The number in the UK is about 2,200. The next highest is Germany with 197 jobs. There's nowhere to go. I mean, it's New York. But you know, the Americans want to keep their jobs. Okay, so we've got to Switzerland. Just going up, France is a little bit more unequal. But the median family in France is many thousands of euros better off than the median family in Britain. When people tell you that the French economy is a basket case, you have to ask them, well, how come the average family is so much better off in France then? And that is before you take account of housing costs, which is lower. And then the Netherlands, which is a middle country, Ireland, Canada, Greece, Spain, Italy, New Zealand, Australia. Now we're getting really unequal, and we're coming to Israel, where the best off 10 for families in Israel have 13 times more a year to spend, this is after tax, than the worst off 10 for countries in Israel. This data is from the UN. And you might understand why Israel is that divided. What is hard to understand is why the United Kingdom has bigger economic divides between its well-off and its poor than Israel. It really is extreme. Portugal, with an incredibly poor set of people that want society and an aristocracy, a bit like ours at the top, was in 2010 slightly more unequal. That is no longer the case. The poor in Portugal had nothing to lose. House prices in Portugal in the middle have halved. Equality has increased in Portugal. Often equality increases through various forms of disaster. Then the United States, and finally Singapore. Which is a very interesting little city state and somewhere we can look at if we want to worry about where we might be heading. Where I think we need much more work is what happens in these different countries and at different times. How do people interact with each other? How do they behave? How do we get used to this and learn how to treat people in a way that means that we don't look them in the eye unless we think they're social equals? If you're above me, I'm going to look over your shoulder, down on your shoes, but you look differently. George Orwell noticed this when he went to Barcelona, at the time of incredible equality in Barcelona, but you can see it all around you. You can see it in the people shuffling around with the trolleys upstairs in the halls. The beginning, as soon as you start doing this work, I'm afraid you begin to get obsessed by noticing everyday behaviour of people, how people behave in restaurants if they get to eat in restaurants, how very supposedly left-wing people completely ignore the person serving them at the table because they just happen to have been brought up in England at this time. And these things are endemic. There's all kinds of patterns. I'm not going to show you graphs of these, you'll be glad to know. But all kinds of patterns that correlate with inequality. The amount of money you tip 20%, maybe 25% dips in America. I'm not sure what our tipping levels got to here. It correlates with inequality. In more equal countries, you don't have tips because the people who work in restaurants are paid enough that they don't need tips to survive. In fact, it costs so much to go to a restaurant. Take an equal country like Switzerland. It costs so much money to go to restaurants in Switzerland that you don't go that often. When you go, you really enjoy it. And the people making your food really enjoy it as well. They come out and say hello to you. That's not what happens in Britain. It's very different. It's not the end of the world. You don't need to go out and eat, you know, more than once every couple of weeks or so. What's the quid pro quo in Switzerland? You can have a house. It is relatively cheap, partly because they've controlled who's allowed to have houses. This title comes from The Economist. It was The Economist describing David Cameron's announcement that inequality had fallen. When David Cameron announced just a few months ago that inequality had fallen in the UK, he was talking about the blue line. The blue line compares the worst off person in the top 10% with the best off person in the bottom 10%. And it is true. If you ignore 10% of the population and take a person on around about £45,000-£50,000 a year household income, and then take a person not at the very bottom of the poor, but 10 percentage points up, they've come together. There's been an all in it together move in the last few years. The Institute for Fiscal Studies have shown this happening since 2008. The Gini coefficient of inequality of income has dropped back to what it was in 1992, as long as you ignore the top 1%. Our inequalities are driven by the top 1%. When the top 1% take as huge a share as they take in the UK, which is about 15% of all income, the people just beneath that best off 10th end up taking more than they take in other countries. They don't feel better off because the best off 1% is so much better off above them. We're talking here in Bristol, £200,000 a year. So anybody getting £200,000 a year in their family or above is in the best off 1%. So what happens is that people earning between 100 and 120,000 in Bristol, as a couple say, complain about the really well-paid clinical professor and the pro vice chancellor and the director of the hospital and all those other people who can buy the nice houses near here or just up a mile and a half over there. Those people who are complaining are actually better off than their counterparts in other parts of Europe in terms of income, but of course the cost of housing is higher for them, so they don't actually have any more money. This slide is too small. I had to get all the caveats in just for my weird sense of scientific integrity. That's why the text is very small. But what I'm showing in that table in the middle is the update. And the update has United States top, Singapore now second. Singapore has introduced capital control since 2008 to stop rich people who are moving around the world buying property in Singapore because they thought it might end in disaster. So what's happened is the Chinese have jumped over Singapore and come to London. Israel's managed to jump up slightly, it's on a par with us, and Portugal has shot down. But it's very similar. The data is very hard to get, and I'm going to show you something which is very naughty now, but it's all you can really do. If you take these four countries for which we have data at two points in time and simply project forward, the result is scary. The result, if we get to 2030, is that the United Kingdom is about to win the global race. We are on track at the moment to become the most unequal country in the rich world. The way it's happened is that Obama has introduced some taxes. Corporate taxes are actually increasing in the United States. We have done the opposite. We've taken corporation tax down from 28% in 2010 to 20% now. It's going to go down to 18%. It's a whole lot of moves that have meant that we're going to be overtaking the United States, and Singapore is beginning to put a lid on it slightly. So that's where we're currently heading. We are unlikely to get there. Because whenever a country is extreme, the most likely thing is it stops being so extreme. It would take quite a lot of effort for us to actually be in that position and carry on. But just look at the Netherlands. Look at where we could be. There's nothing alien about the Netherlands. It's rather like Germany. It's not a different set of people. think William of Orange was actually from the Netherlands when it, you know, the last semi-successful invasion of this country. But people made a different decision in the Netherlands in the 1970s, and that has huge repercussions for what society is like in the Netherlands and where it's heading. This shows you just how dodgy that projection is, because it's the only one we can do. There's a second one we can do, which I haven't got a graph of, which is public spending. If you look at the proportion of our GDP spent on public services, we are way at the bottom, and we are heading to go below the United States and to be the lowest public spender, I think, in about 5 years' time. And you have to remember, public spending in the United States include spending on their military. So that's where we are heading at the moment. The poor are about to become dramatically poorer. The welfare cuts have largely come through. We're going to see those happen. Some people, possibly in London, may get that £9 an hour wage. But of course, they're going to lose their tax credits. Much, much more importantly than that, they're going to have to rent. And they're going to have no control whatsoever over their rent. Rents are currently rising far, far higher than anybody's income is rising. The proportion of property in London that is rented is going up by over 1% a year. At this rate, the whole of London will be rented by 2060. It's a boom time for landlords. Landlords have made £400 million since 2008 in the increased value of their property. It wasn't planned. It is strange, and it has all kinds of repercussions. You end up with a kind of Blade Runner future, I'm afraid. If you project forward the way we are, you do end up with this kind of dystopian vision. And the scary thing for Britain is that although trickle-down has been discredited worldwide, it is theoretically possible to have trickle-down in one country. You could set up your country as being the place for the super rich of the world to come, give them the lowest property taxes in the universe, say just £1,300 a year in Westminster and Chelsea. You could supply them with schools and universities for their children as long as they pay the fees that they can get into them, you know, fancy them up with all kind of marketing stuff to tell them how wonderful that this is. You could supply a set of servants to look after their hotel rooms, to clean their houses, to nanny their children and all the rest of it. And in theory, you could live on the trickle-down of that wealth. This is what Boris Johnson talks about when he says he's very happy that the highest billionaires per head is in London. There's been estimates of how many jobs a very rich person makes. My favourite estimates come from Camelot. Camelot claimed that the average millionaire winner creates 6 jobs. Including a personal beautician. I went to see my local school recently to see what they were doing, and there's a practical block where you learn your BTECs and the boys were learning how to take apart bicycles and that kind of thing. It reminded me of the 1970s in a way, where we were working out how to use lathes because we were going to go and work in a car factory. Now you work out to take about how to take bicycles apart from middle class people who can't be bothered to fix their own bike. And what were the girls doing? These are 15-year-old girls. They were learning how to massage. BTEC, learning how to massage. With massage tables in the school. Right. That's trickled down in one country. But I don't think that poster, that picture is, you know, unwarranted when you go and see things like that happening. It was not great before the crash, and we need to see where the kind of ideas that say this kind of inequality is inevitable come from. This little pie chart is showing you how children in the Netherlands were described by the OECD. I think this is quite recent data, 2012. The OECD no longer use those names. They used those names in 2006 for their categories of ability. They've taken the names off their website, but their methodology is exactly the same for assigning children by their tests at various levels of ability. Here are the graphs, the most recent graphs for some of these countries, of children at the age of 15 having been measured by test for how good they are at English and maths and so on. And you'll see that all near perfect bell curves. The reason they are near perfect bell curves is because the OECD, through their PISA statistics, take the data they get and adjust it before they release it so it looks like a perfect bell curve. Why do they do this? They do this not because they're being Machiavellian. People in the OECD really believe that human ability is distributed as a bell curve. So if they're not getting a bell curve when they test the students, it must be their tests aren't good enough. But you can take any distribution of data and standardize it back to a bell curve and then give it out and then tell a country that only 2% of its children are truly able or gifted at learning these levels. And this kind of talk has gathered steam. Things can really change very rapidly. If you're getting depressed about all of this, you just need to look back and think how quickly things changed in the past. When I was at school, we got caned. There had been some advancement, only the boys got caned by then. Corporal punishment was then abolished in state schools. You could pay for the privilege of your children to be caned, and the private schools kept it. If you just think about the last 5 years of developments and so on, anybody was to suggest it might be a good idea to take a cane to your child now. Incredibly fast changing attitudes can happen. It is wrong to be depressed and think that things cannot change very, very quickly. But there wasn't one day we woke up and suddenly said this was wrong. What happened is a small group of people who thought it was wrong became a slightly larger group of people who thought it was wrong. And a small group of people who really liked caning became a smaller group. And then they started to shut up about the fact they liked caning. They became a bit embarrassed. And there still will be people. There will be people out there who think really we need a bit of rigour in our schools. You know, just a clip around the ear would be okay. But I suspect that's gone forever. But there are other things that people in the future will look at. Just like we now look at caning and say, how could they have done that? And I think you could actually understand how they could have done that in the context. People in the future will look at our rates of anxiety and depression amongst 15-year-old girls. This is data from North America, showing the rate rising pretty linearly, which means it's a strange time because it cannot carry on rising like that forever. But they'll say, how on earth did they not notice that so many young women in particular by the age of 15 were so anxious and so depressed that when a clinician interviewed them, they said that on the proper clinical scale they really had a mental illness. How did we not notice the degree of self-harm and anorexia going on? How did we not react to that? And the reason is because we became used to it. This is data for North America. You get similar things for Britain. But it's taken from a paper which looked at data from every country which had done this kind of test. And that paper concluded that there was no rise in anxiety and depression amongst adolescents. The reason it concluded there was no rise is because it included the more recent studies from places like Scandinavia and Japan. All I've done is take Scandinavia and Japan and all the other countries out and just left North America in to show you how the rates are much higher there. There's a very, very strong correlation between poor mental health and inequality between rich countries. This is the uptake of Prozac and other selective serotonin vehicles, whatever they're called, in Scotland. And at the time I did the first edition of Injustice, there seemed to be a little bit of hiatus around about 2006, but you can see the rate going up. Some people can take an awfully large amount of Prozac, but essentially it's 1 in 10 of all Scots are being medicated to take themselves away from the current situation that they're in. And one way in which you can sustain high degrees of inequality is by medicating the population. Marx famously said it was alcohol. Now it's slightly more targeted drugs. And it's not a conspiracy, but you end up with more people taking these things in places where there is more supposed competition. You also end up with very good things happening in places that you might not think is possible. I just talked for about 4 minutes more and then I'll shut up. Along the bottom here you've got the take of the 1%, with the USA almost 20% of all income being taken by the best of 1% in the USA. And along the y-axis you've got the proportion of people who walk or cycle to work There's a correlation. It isn't that people wake up one day in the country, check their special social weather meter, look at the inequality level and say, okay, I'm going to cycle to work today. Right? It doesn't, obviously doesn't work like that. It's not cause and effect. What you're seeing is societies that are better at organising themselves, and a large part of organising yourself means controlling the greedy and developing capricious. Societies that become better at doing that are also better at arranging their planning so that people can live near where they work and you build cycle lanes. If you look at similar health data for smoking and drinking, you don't get this correlation because you can decide on your own to smoke or drink. Incredible rate of smoking and drinking in Japan, for instance. You cannot decide on your own to paint a cycle lane. Well, possibly in Bristol near Tesco as you could, but anywhere else in the country you might get in trouble for doing it. And you certainly can't design a zonal system so that you can live near where you work. But this didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of people in the 1970s in the Netherlands protesting about the number of children who were dying on the roads and carry on protesting about that to end up the situation they have now. Let's make this the last graph, because as you see, I have far too many graphs. But it's a good one to end on because it's about politics and where we are with elections. This is a segregation index. People normally calculate segregation indices for people who are not white, or for students, who are actually the most ghettoized community in the country, or for the rich, who kind of rival students in terms of how ghettoized they are. But this is a segregation index for Conservative voters for the whole of the UK. And what it tells you is that if you go back to the 1918 Kharkiv election, you would have had to move 20% of Conservative voters around the country very carefully. All the moves have to be the right move to get an even distribution of Conservatives everywhere. That segregation index fell and fell and fell through to the 1960s and 1970s. This is as the vote goes up and down, different parties win elections, but all the time the segregation index fell. So that by the 60s and 70s you've got Conservatives everywhere, nowhere with very few Conservatives, nowhere with lots of Conservatives. At times that can be a great disadvantage if you're trying to win an election, as the Greens found out recently, you don't really want your support spread everywhere. But then it came to an end in 1974. That's the green vertical bar in the chart. In October 1974, the Conservative vote in the southeast of England rose very rapidly. Not enough for them to win the election, but that's the beginning of things changing. Margaret Thatcher was elected in 1975, or not elected, whatever they did back then. Tiny drop down to 1979, and then we get relentless increases in the polarisation of the Conservative vote. So that by 2010, the Conservative vote was so polarised, it was going up most in places where they already held MPs, that they failed to form a government and had to join a coalition with Liberals. And at this point, I said, they're in really bad trouble. You know, if you've got this long-term trend and your votes becoming more polarised, and the biggest increase in your support is in areas you already hold, how on earth can you win an election? And it's a nice example of getting it wrong yet again. They won by 12 MPs. They didn't just win, they saw an increase in the polarisation of their vote that outstripped the increase in the last three elections. This has nothing to do with Scotland. There's been hardly any Conservative voters for years in Scotland, so that line is not about Scotland whatsoever. The Conservatives won despite an abysmal distribution of votes in one way. They won despite only one in four of the electorate voting for them, because of the most incredible distribution of the opposition party's votes, which fell and rose in just the right way to allow a political party with only one in four of the electorate voting for them to actually get a majority in the House of Commons. The Liberals dropping in the southwest was key, but it is quite remarkable. To just end with one last fact about how remarkable it is, I think there's only one democracy in the world, in the history of democracies, that comes close to this, and that's the United States of America. The United States of America, only around about 52-53% of people might vote, so the president has to get 27-28% of the electorate. even in the United States of America, presidents are elected with a higher proportion of electorate than have elected the government in Britain at the moment. It is incredibly precarious. You've got no idea what's going to happen. We are really, really odd and very strange. Inequalities are increasing. The middle class are beginning to get angry about it. Whether the working class got to this solution a very long time ago by what's happening. But I really wouldn't believe anybody who tells you that they can predict that one person or another can or cannot win an election in 5 years' time when you're in a situation which is extreme as this, when you have to go back to 1918, you have to go back to the last time a third party won more than 50 seats. Last time that was when Sinn Féin won 70 seats. That's when Ireland left. There really are no precedents for where we are at the moment. We just need to recognise that this is not a place to be. And if anybody tells you this is normal and all countries are unequal and it's just a global trend, they're either lying or they're stupid. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Danny, and I've got a funny feeling that that might have provoked a whole range of different questions. So we'll follow the pattern of earlier today where we'll take two or three questions at a time. So hands up if you'd like to ask a question. We've got a man at the back in the blue shirt and somebody over here, the sun is in my eyes, and a man at the side. I'll run down this side, please.
Why don't you go first? You're here. Take these three.
Thank you very much, that's great. Your presentation, I was someone who grew up in the 60s and 70s, so your presentation explains why I'm so angry about where we are now. My question's a political one, because I've noticed from looking at the delegates, I think I'm about the only campaign group here today. It's all very straightforward in terms of the facts of the situation, but what do we need to do to get rid of this show? And where might Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party figure in that?
Thanks, Dan Myers from the Sheffield Women's Centre for Animals and Social Justice. I was interested in your thoughts on the implications for political power of inequality, because I mean it's often framed just in economic terms, but I think it has very dangerous political implications as well, especially given the theme of the conference about democracy and power. So yeah, I'm interested in your thoughts on its effects on that.
Catherine
Hughes,
a really great talk, and although I've read a lot of your work and seen you talk many times, each time is still shocking, which I think says something about where we're at. My question relates to the first question, which is how much of a responsibility do you feel we as academics who are analysing what the problems are have to also be presenting alongside that potential solutions? And it's easy to see how you can go down a kind of dystopian route to thinking about where we might go. Should we also be balancing that with some kind of engagement with utopian thinking?
Yeah. Okay, thanks for the questions. It's shocking because when you outlay these things, what you get is much more shocking than what you produced 5 years ago. I have little statistics about what the most expensive private nurseries were in New York and London. They now cost four times more per child than they cost in 2010. So things are really odd at the moment. If you look at the number of deaths of people within the certain time they're being sanctioned, or the suicides, the lady who was pregnant and jumped off the balcony with holding her toddler, examples like that 5 years ago. Yeah, so I'm pretty sure it isn't me talking it up. I think if I found examples like that 10 years ago, 5 years ago, I would have done it. It's just that more extreme things are happening. It would be great then if we did more talk about utopia and what things could be like. I mean, you don't have to call it utopia, I just call it the Netherlands. not even Germany or Scandinavia. Why, if you're the bottom of the class of 25, would you really aim to suddenly jump to the top? What you aim is to actually give, can I be in the middle? So we should be looking at the middle. and saying, what can we do that countries in the middle do? And how can we incrementally move towards there? As long as their quality increases between 2 years, you're going in the right way. The question about democracy, but the problem is that the more unequal your country gets, the less democratic power you've got, and the more their population get fooled, the more innumerable the population become. So although I don't like some of those tests the OECD does, international tests of numeracy are pretty reliable because maths is the same everywhere. And in the United States, people are most likely to believe their children will be in 1%. Over a quarter of people believe their children will be in 1%. In the more numerous or equal countries, people are better at maths. The democratic correlation is quite incredible. I mean, Singapore only has one political party. It's not a democracy. The United States has two. Till recently, we only had three, and we barely had three. And as you head towards Japan, I'm afraid, upsets this one slightly, it's becoming more interesting. But for most of the more equal countries, they have a form of democracy with at least eight parties so that you can find somebody you want to vote for. On Corbyn, what we should do, the brilliant thing about Corbyn is it isn't Corbyn. He didn't want to stand. It's not about him. It's about 700,000 people who wanted to pay £3. Not me, I was a bit lazy and I needed to get lots of emails. It's not about him. He can die of a heart attack tomorrow. It's about the people around him and the whole set of people who are moving in a particular direction, including a lot of Labour MPs who would have said if asked that they really wouldn't want him as leader. But now watch what they do. Watch them pay shadow cabinet posts. Watch them hanging on in there. Very few, I suspect, are going to defect across the Conservatives. Some may. It'll be interesting. It'll show a degree of truth. But it's a general move. It doesn't rely on one or two people. And if you look back, this is what you saw in the past. Nobody talks about Clement Attlee being a wonderful leader. There's a whole set of people around that in the movement at the time that did it. If you look at what was said about Wilson at the time, or Barbara Castle and so on, it was very vicious, what was written in the 1670s, but there were several of them. And behind them, there was a much larger group of people, and there was a general belief. So what matters about the Corbyn election, and the rise of the Green Party, and even disaffected UKIP votes, and the rest of it, is a sense that something has to alter. The UKIP votes, by the way, if you're getting depressed about them, if you ever wanted a sign that we're becoming a normal European country, getting a far-right party that's semi-popular is one of the credentials of being a normal. And it's a bit clear. But the reason why we haven't had one for years, if you remember the 70s National Front, who weren't particularly nice in 77 or 78, the National Front disappeared in 1979. Absolutely. And it disappeared because there was no need for them. Margaret Thatcher said almost everything that they wanted to say. So UKIP have risen, partly because our main right-wing party cannot no longer be as racist as it used to be. So even that, you can see a sign of hope in. But what we need to do is to paint ideas about what would it be like if you didn't worry about being evicted? What would it be like if you weren't concerned about school league table rankings? And the danger of what the left does at the moment is it harks back to what it achieved in that golden era from the 1920s through to the 70s and says, can we create comprehensive schools like we did then? Can we create council estates like we did then? Can we even open up minds like we had then? It doesn't think, what's the modern equivalent to what would be progressive now? And it isn't asking young people to go down the pit in the future. So there's a lot to be done, but the main thing I think that needs to be done is working out the equivalent progressive thinking that was done in the past on things like education and housing and jobs and security that isn't trying to replicate the time of people's grandparents. It is about some form of security to get those levels of anxiety and depression down amongst the young. Just so the young people in Britain know they will be sheltered, there will be a job for them, they won't necessarily be rich, but they will be able to choose who they mix with, and they might even be able to afford to have a baby. It's not asking very much.
Okay, I want to get two more rounds of questions. So who would like to ask a question? Okay, man here.
Okay, Danny, thanks for that. I'm Christine Ming, Bristol Geography. I'm doing a paper with one of your colleagues, Ron Johnston, and we're interested in the public attitudes to inequality and how they may change over time. And, you know, with the sort of paradox that I can't understand is why people aren't outraged by your story, the public, for example, and why there seems to be a disconnect. People not understand the level of inequality, or do they feel that there's nothing to be done about it, it's just accepted. And I think, you know, while most people are concerned about inequality, they don't believe that, you know, it's a role for the state to actually do something about it. And maybe that's changing with Labour and Corbyn and stuff, but it's still a puzzle for the last 30 years on why the situation is. Thank you.
Hi, Danny. Stuart Smith from the University of Sheffield. Thanks very much for the presentation, eye-opening and eye-watering again. I wanted to ask about housing policy. There's reading the book, All That's Solid, it's very clear early on about the we've never had more rooms available to us and there's inequalities, but yet you still have, amongst the virtually all the politicians, things like the Lions Review coming out and saying we need to build more houses, we just need to keep building. And indeed it's seen as part of an economic stimulus as well, and all the arguments around that. So I wonder, since you wrote the book, have you reflected further on implications for housing policy about what you wrote in last year?
Heather Sabine at Bournemouth University. I really enjoyed your talk, thank you. And I was just thinking about that question that came from the front. And I think the public are angry about this, and I think that has been reflected in Corbyn's election. But I think one of the things that gets missed out of these conversations is the way that the media don't reflect public anger, and the way that the media don't replicate the kind of conversations you're having. And I just wondered about your reflections on that.
Okay. On what gets people angry, the other way around is to look at what is the most salient issue in elections. And academics were pretty quiet about this because 2005, I think before, the most salient issue was immigration. We tried to look at all kinds of ways of not saying it. The economic crash meant that in 2010 election, the economy just beat immigration as the most salient issue. So people will get angry about something. It is related to the press and so on. But also, one way to stop people worrying about inequality is to tell them that the reason they find it hard to get a well-paid job, and the reason that they find it hard to buy houses, the reason that there doesn't seem to be a place in a new school for their child, is the immigrants. It's a really easy way to deflect people from inequality. And if you believe that inequality is good, I don't think we've recognised that there are members of the Conservative Party who believe that inequality is good, because they're very good at PR. If you believe inequality is good and actually reflects a society that's doing very well and rewarding its gifted, and you need special schools that are very expensive for specially gifted children and actually your children and so on, you can't tell the public that. You can't tell the public, look, you know, I'm very clever, I was sent to boarding school at 13, yes it cost a lot of money, but it made my head even bigger. And then I was the first from Brasos College and I went to work for Carlton TV, and I'm just so super intelligent that you're lucky to have me as your Prime Minister. But I don't expect you to understand that because you're not like me. That's why you brought children to go to very cheap schools. You know that's not going to work as a message. So you find other things to talk about. But also, keeping Britain British, while at the same time actually letting tens of hundreds of thousands of people in because your friends in business tell you that that's what you've got to do. So I think there's a connection there. I think people should be talking about housing more than inequality. It's much easier to talk about rents and mortgages. Housing affects everybody, whereas jobs don't. And just looking at the cost of housing, in the sense of the way of looking at inequality, after all, there is a landlord who's getting that rent. And a landlord isn't really, you know, knocking themselves out to redecorate your flat. And it is somebody receiving that money from the mortgage, even at low interest rates, should be paying double back. What you get. So if you talk about housing costs rather than housing, you get to the number of the issue. There's also ways in which issues now that people are very bothered about, being that it's somebody who's gay. If you're trying to explain to the population 20 years ago that it really ought to be bothered about this, you know, we were criminalising people, it was terrible what was going on, and then we were making teachers lie to children by passing that clause in an Education Act. Could you get the population bothered about that? Whereas if you try to do that now, can you imagine Elton John's tour going around the country? So things change. On housing, I have softened slightly over we do need to do a bit more building. You can tell I'm not a politician. But there's one reason we do need to build a bit urgently, and that's because we've had the most incredible immigration. And the biggest rise in immigration has actually been in the last year. Huge increase, and you have to build for immigrants. You can't, otherwise you don't have enough housing. Thankfully, the figures for last year came out on the 28th of August, and I've forgotten the exact date when the picture of that little boy on the beach appeared, but it appeared just in time to stop any newspaper reporting the immigration figures. But you can't have high net immigration and not build. You also need to be able to replace stock that's falling apart. You need to build small flats and apartments for people to downsize into that's near where they live because they've got their friends and they won't go away. So the place you need to build more than anywhere else is actually around the city of Oxford on the Greenbelt, but for some reason my new neighbours seem to think it's terribly important. Within 3 miles of the middle of the city that you can cycle in from, instead of having 40,000 cars driving across that Greenbelt every day. And you probably need to build a bit more in Bristol, and you certainly need to build quite a lot more up in London. Or, just vote to leave Europe and have an almighty economic crash, and then there'll be no need to build any more houses and flats anymore, because we'll go off and we'll get jobs working in Germany again, and nobody will come here. I mean, and that's an easier solution to housing. And actually, it's an easier solution to reducing inequality. It's just that I want to live here for the next 20 years.
Okay, I'm sorry, we are out of time. I want to live here too. I also want to get a cup of tea and a biscuit. It has been fantastic having Danny here, as always. Yeah, big round of applause.